Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast, by guitarists for guitarists. And now your hosts, John Brown and A.L. Levy.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We've been running conversations with some of the best guitar players in the game for over a year now. Not only has this been amazing for myself and A.L. to learn from, but it's been amazing for us to share this vast knowledge with all of you. If you enjoy what we're doing, then please share us with your friends, and we especially love iTunes reviews. Remember that you can tag us if you want to share the podcast on your Instagram. You can find me at Brown Monuments. That's BROWNEMONUMENTS. And you can find AL at AL Levy URM Audio. That's EYALLEVIURMAUDIO. Always remember that we will never charge you for this podcast. So please keep listening and enjoying. All we ask in return is a share, post, and a tag. Anyway, let's get on to this week's guest.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Our guest today is Per Nilsson, who is a guitar player, songwriter, and producer out of Sweden. Per is one of the founding members of the Swedish mellow death group Scar Symmetry. He is also well known for performing with acts such as Meshuga and Nocturnal Rites. He's done a bunch of work as both a producer and guest musician for artists such as Zonaria, God Forbid, Scale of Summit, a bunch more. He is truly one of the most phenomenal guitar players, I'd say, in the world, and a really cool dude. Let's do this.
Per Nilsson, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Pretty good. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. It's been a while since we had you on the URM podcast. That was years and years and years ago. A lot's happened since then.
I must have been a pretty early participant in that thing, right?
You were. You were one of the first. You've had a lot of life happen since then.
Yeah, I suppose.
When was that? 2015?
Might have been, yeah. Makes sense.
Man, time fucking flies, doesn't it? One thing that I was very curious about, I wanted to pick your brain on this. So I was not aware. I don't know how I wasn't aware. Maybe I was aware and I forgot, and I apologize if I was aware and I forgot, but I wasn't aware that you've had to basically work around an injury. That's a very interesting topic for me because working around limitations, I think, is how people become great at something once they accept it and figure out how to work with it. So I'm curious about what your mental process was like for coming to terms with it and then figuring out what you could do in spite of.
I had that problem for the first time when I was maybe 19. I had to stop for half a year. And at that time, it was pretty devastating to me, being a young guy full with ego and confidence and all that teenage stuff. And suddenly I was robbed of this one ability that made me, feel special or something. And I got over it pretty quickly, and then I could play for a few more years. But then it happened again, and then I had to stop for well over 4 years. I didn't really play at all. And I was maybe 23 when it happened the second time. At first, I thought that, I had this problem before, so hopefully it will be a few months and then I'll be back. But I soon enough realized that it was going to be for a longer time, or possibly, forever. Who knows? When your arms are aching every day, all day. I tried all these different treatments, acupuncture, massage, and cortisone injections. I met up with orthopedic specialists to see if I was a candidate for surgery. And they thought that I wasn't I can't remember the specifics, but yeah, they advised against surgery. So after a while, I was just this is going to stick with me, and I have to figure out something else to do. Or at least this was my process, that I came to the conclusion that I cannot be, lingering on this thing. I need to move on to something else, which I did. And that was a big shift for me when I just decided that I was not going to be depressed about it anymore. I'm just going to do something else. From there on, it felt much better.
It's interesting, to actually accept that it's definitely a choice.
Yeah. And it was impossible to continue grieving the thing that I had lost.
What was the injury, just out of interest?
I guess like a repetitive strain injury, but it was in both my arms.
So this is something that when I was 18, this kind of like hits close to home because I was very much into being a shredder like through my teenage years and like just doing that. I mean, I was into writing, but like I was very much going down that path. And then when I was 18, I like injured both of my arms at the same time.
Yeah.
Doing pushups. It just like I fucked up my forearms and my wrists one day on vacation in Italy. I remember exactly when it happened. It was just severe pain in my arms like all the time. I had to stop playing for like 6 weeks or 2 months, and like it never really got better. And I did all therapists and massage and like all the shit, but it never really got better. What would happen is every single time that I'd like get into practicing heavily, like there would be just this speed threshold or like this hours threshold where if I went over it, like it would just start burning to the point where I couldn't play. There was just no way around it. Like I couldn't fix it. And that made me change my focus. Like I changed my focus to being a better writer, like specifically, and like not worrying about being like the greatest guitar player on earth. It was mentally really, really tough when it happened, but it was probably the best thing. Once I made that decision, it was a great thing. But honestly, like that problem never resolved itself until I took the long break from guitar. Like I don't have that problem now, but like it took taking years off for it to fix itself. Wondering, was it like that with you? Like the long break fixed it basically?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if there was any particular thing that happened that made like the injuries or the pain that I had go away. But there was a sort of a shift in my life about a year or so before I could start playing again. It was that I moved from Stockholm where I lived back to the area that I was from. I started living a bit healthier lifestyle, not as much junk food and cigarettes and alcohol. And I had a better job. Like, so there were things like that as well that might have helped, I think. That's like the only thing that really changed. But still, there was a lot of change.
Do you think that mindset helped a lot as well? Because obviously you said you moved out of Stockholm, went back to where you're from, and you know, you had a new job, you were earning more money. Do you reckon that by that point, because it was obviously 3 years in at that point, do you reckon that the mindset of just being in a more positive mindset might have helped as well, you get back to being able to play the guitar?
Yeah, it might have. It doesn't help to have a super gloomy outlook on things.
No.
No, it helps your depression if that's what you want to get better at, basically.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me, man, because like when I hear about people taking breaks, you usually don't hear about people taking years and years off then coming back and like doing it even more. So I'm like, I'm really interested in what it was like coming back, because like I can relate to it a lot. Like I'm wondering if it was like this for you. Once I got past the initial physical barrier of, wow, I haven't played in a long time, like I'm not as good as I was and I need to like work to get that back, you know, once it, like my sophistication is down, like I need to work to like first of all get back to where I was and then get better from there, like so that kind of occupied me for a while. But then once that I got that out of the way, I found that my musical instincts are way better than they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's like during that entire time, I was still developing my ear and my instincts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like my brain is in a much more advanced place than it was when I stopped. Like, was it like that for you?
Exactly the same. Because my life before my injury was all about music and guitar, and like every wake hour, I was thinking about music and in different ways. I was practicing guitar. I was practicing, like, I wrote, like, a counterpoint harmony, like, four-part harmony, like, classical. It was just music, music, music. So when I couldn't play anymore, I mean, that didn't change. I was still thinking about music all the time. I was thinking about guitar all the time. So, and in my mind, it was like I continued to practice. I was exploring like scales and chords and stuff, but I couldn't do it on a fretboard. So I had to do it in my mind, and I had to sort of listen to the stuff that I played inside of my head. And I also bought a little Yamaha sequencer, like a little, like General MIDI sounds that I used to write quite a lot of music, and I could like step write stuff. Actually, some of that stuff has ended up on the last couple of Scar Symmetry albums. There's been some ideas and riffs from that time that's eventually made it into onto my albums, which is kind of cool. It's like completes the circle.
Have you heard of Psy Opus by any chance? You remember that band Psy Opus?
Yes, of course. What was that guy's name again, the guitar?
Chris Arp.
Yeah.
Perry, are you familiar with this dude?
I don't think so. No.
They were in the mid-2000s. And okay, so they were around the time when Dillinger Escape Plan was like a thing, and like, you know, like Ion Dissonance, and like, mm-hmm. I think Meshuggah was already known, but not like what they are now, but like still like the whole like math thing was kind of blowing up, and they were a very extreme, technical, atonal, crazy band. And I remember this guitar player who's kind of like one of those like genius types. Forgive me if I'm wrong, anybody listening. I don't remember if he went to jail or the hospital or something. Something happened where he was not able to play for like 6 months or a year or something. He was like somewhere.
Yeah.
And forgive me if it wasn't either of those. Maybe it was a job saving people somewhere. I don't know. But like he wasn't able to play. And so he drew a fretboard on a piece of cardboard and visualized their next record on that cardboard. He just imagined himself playing it. And wrote the whole thing in his head.
Wow.
Seeing it. And dude, this is really crazy music too. Like it's not.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like Behold the Octopus, if you've ever heard that band.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's literally Ion Dissonance and Dillinger Escape Plan went and took crack, basically. Yeah, that guy's playing is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like your story reminds me of that a little bit, that like you're still developing your abilities. And do you think that your ability to improvise is influenced at all from that time period?
I think so, that it was influenced by that a lot. And the year before I had my injuries, I went to school and I had a really great theory and improvisation teacher. And I learned like concepts that I sort of worked on during my injury years. And it's like, you know, when I listen to music, I couldn't play along to the songs, but I could listen to the songs and I could, you know, make out the kind of harmonies they used. And I could be like, oh, that's nice. That's a 4 minor or something. And I could, you know, keep working on my vocabulary and my like toolbox of tricks and things that I could use. It's just that I couldn't immediately perform them, but still, you know, I kept piling things up in my brain. So once I could start playing again, at first, just a few minutes at a time, and then I gradually grew. But I pretty instantly could tell that, you know, a lot of stuff had happened. And I think I was a much, much better guitar player than when I stopped playing.
How long did it take you to, like, get the physical side of it back?
I can't really remember, but actually getting the technique and the chops back, that was actually pretty quick. But it took several years, I guess, to get back to being able to play several hours a day.
Have you ever had any point where it felt like it was going to come back since that moment?
Not really like that bad, but I've had times when I have been working a lot by the computer, you know, like back in the day when you...
That'll do it.
Yeah.
When you had to edit drums before there was any beat detective, and when everything like that had to be done manually, and I worked on albums. Yeah. And I killed my arms using the keyboard and the mouse. So there were a few times doing stuff like that for 14 hours a day, where I felt like, this is not good.
I sometimes feel like if I push the limits of how much physical strain I can take from either down picking too much or like using the mouse too much, like I can feel like if I keep going for too long, like I'm going to re-trigger it. But it's like, I know what to do to not make it happen, I guess. Is it kind of like that for you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Was it you think maybe a lack of awareness when you were younger that just you didn't know how to stop it? Like you didn't even know. I feel like mm-hmm. the awareness for this type of injury wasn't the same as it is now, just like
yeah.
in society. Back then, like, people knew about these injuries, but it wasn't like some big studied thing.
I wanted to practice and play and work on music every hour that I was awake. And I had like some of my influences when I was 17 or so was guys like Steve I, who had his like 10-hour workout. And I had that number of, I don't know if it was Guitar Player or Guitar World, where they had that entire thing laid out, Steve I's 10-hour workout.
I remember that.
Yeah, and so I was actually like doing my own 10-hour workouts. So it was pretty crazy. There's a lot of things that you shouldn't do for 10 hours straight. Even if I did, you know, take rests, it's still too much. I took rest and then I took like an hour off to write 4-part harmony or something like more theoretical.
So that was your break?
So yeah, so that was my break.
A nice relaxing fugue.
4-part.
So I want to hear about this 10-hour workout just because I love that kind of shit.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it's such a bad idea. But like, you know, I do think though, like, man, if you want to be great at an instrument, you kind of have to have some period of your life where you're doing that. You just need to be careful, basically, not do too much. But what was in it? What was your 10-hour workout?
It's a long time ago.
Do you remember?
When I was still in my teens, it was still very technique focused. So it could be like 1 hour of alternate picking and 1 hour of sweep picking.
That still leaves 8 hours.
It does. And then it was 1 hour of writing 4-part harmony.
Every day?
Yeah. Every day.
That's nuts.
That was a great thing for learning, like voice leading and stuff.
But like, say, for the hour of alternate picking, is it like the same thing every day? Like there's a set of patterns you work on, or you change it?
Well, I changed it up all the time, but I actually like wrote down the exercises that I was going to work on. Like, so I alternate picking and I did stuff on 2 adjacent strings and 2 non-adjacent strings and on 3 strings and on, you know, and same thing with when I came to sweep picking, I did sweeps on 2 strings and 3 strings and so on. And some of the like hours, if I did the tapping hour, that was probably like not as much exercise as it was more exploration, trying to come up with new kind of patterns to play. I did the improvisation hours where I like decided to focus on like one scale or mode and modulated through a series of keys that had nothing to do with each other, like jump all over the circle of fifths and not go in like a fourth and fifth jump motion.
Okay, yeah.
So I did that and like improvised and try to make sense of that. But it was really technique focused. And like if I had done alternate picking and then sweep picking, and then I could come back and do alternate picking again, you know, later in the day. So, you know, because why not?
Why not?
Why do 1 hour when you could do 2?
Yeah. I always respect people that can play for that amount of time a day, especially so inherently focused on technique. It's something that I've never been able to do, probably from ADHD or something like that. I just, you know, my brain's wandering over there while my hands are here. I was just like, how did you find the discipline to do that? And I'm guessing it was just because you loved the instrument.
Yeah, exactly. And I can have some like focus issues. Like if I'm trying to read a book and the TV is on, that's a problem for me. Then I'm having a hard time reading. My wife is the opposite, so we have some fun with that difference. but for me, like putting the metronome on, and I had an old school, you know, pendulum tick tock tick tock, and then you focus in on that sound, and you try to make everything precise, and boom, 1 hour has gone, and it's been like an hour of being in a like meditative state that I really enjoyed.
That's what I've noticed too. It's like interesting how much it seems like we have similar stuff. Like I actually talk about this with my girlfriend a lot. She can like be on the phone watching TV and doing something else and be engaged with all of them while like if there's more than one thing going on at a time, like I start to get stressed out.
Do you feel the agitation in your heart and then in your brain and it's just like, stop talking?
Yeah, like my skin starts to get prickly and I start to get like angry because like can't focus. But like, yeah, when I work on something, and in the best times of working on something, it'll be like you turn on the metronome or whatever it is I'm working on, but let's just say, yeah, practicing something. And then it's like time just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
It just disappears. It's almost like when you're going to sleep at night and at some point, you know, at that point where you go from being awake to dreaming, but like you don't know when the movie starts playing in your head. Like at some point, the film projector comes on and you're in the movie, but like you don't know when it is, but it just happens. Like it's kind of like that. Like once I overcome like the first 5 minutes, time just disappears. I don't know when it happens, but just disappears. And then time is up. Something happened in that time.
And it's almost like when you get into that weird state, it's like I'm observing myself practice. It's like I'm starting to hear the stuff that I play outside of me playing it.
Yeah.
do you guys get that?
Yeah, totally.
And
when you're improvising, do you hear the note before? Like, is it also not just physically outside of yourself, but like time wise too? As in, like,
yeah,
you hear the music before it happens and it guides you.
No, if I'm not in that state, if I'm in more of a intellectualizing state where I'm practicing improvising and I'm very aware of what I'm playing and I have some things that I wanna put into my improvisation, I'm like preconceiving like what to do. Like I'm, you know, next thing I'm gonna jump up a few frets and do a move. Then I'm aware, you know, of like the next thing that is imminent. But when I improvise for like a long time and I get into that really deep state, then it's more like, you know, this sounds so trippy, but it's only like the moment that exists. So I'm not thinking of what just happened or what is going to happen, because if you do that, like I feel like then I will snap out of it.
Yeah. It's almost like when you're playing live on stage and you kind of go a little bit to autopilot because you've been playing this riff so many times on stage. And then when you actively think about it, it's like, shit, what the fuck is that riff?
Yeah.
Is it like that? Yeah.
Well, not really. Maybe it's similar to that, because I've had that as well when I've been on stage and playing the same song that I did the previous 15 nights. And then I start thinking like, oh yeah, we're having after show pizzas tonight. You know, I start thinking about stuff like that. When I'm improvising and I'm in that like creative flow state, I'm not really thinking of other things. It's like a complete awareness of the music, and it has a little bit of that like observer state. And sometimes when I'm in that state, I get surprised by what I play, which is probably like a result of feeling like an observer.
That's really interesting. Yeah, awesome. Observer state. I've never had that. I'm jealous.
I've had it. I know what you're talking about. So like both of those states that you're talking about, like the intellectual one where you're planning your next move as you're doing the previous one. That's kind of what I meant. I was wondering if you ever do that. But like, so that right there, the reason I brought that up was because we were talking earlier about not being able to multitask well, but that right there is multitasking in real time. So I feel like it's not correct that we say we can't multitask, even though I say I can't multitask. I know it's not correct because I've done that. And like, so if you are playing something and you're thinking of the next thing, you're multitasking. That is exactly what you're doing. So it's interesting to me what things we can multitask and what things like drive us nuts. But like that observer state, do you ever get that when writing music? Like it just kind of happens?
No, not really. I don't think so. No.
What about you, Brown?
No, for me, it's usually triggered by a sequence of notes in a certain order, in a certain rhythm that happens, you know, by accident. And then it sort of, if I latch onto it, if it happens and I catch it, that's kind of how it goes for me. And then I try going down that route. But no, not the observer state. I'm guessing it's happened for you though, AL.
Sometimes. But like the best writing is like this weird, it's like a mix of the two almost. It's like super high speed, like do something and then simultaneously be thinking about the next thing, but also how to improve it and how it works in the bigger picture and like refining it, but not refining it too much. It's hard to explain. It's like this weird, it's like a trance almost. It also is one of those things though where like it's part intellectual, it's part just like who the fuck knows. But then time also disappears. Like before you know it, just like it's been hours and hours and hours. And you have this thing that didn't exist before.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to jump back actually to something you said earlier. You were talking about how you had this metronome, you know, one of the TikTok ones. And is that something that you began your guitar journey with? Because I feel like metronomes were less common amongst heavier guitar players until, you know, everyone started using recording software. I feel like that was like a turning point. So hearing a guitar player that actually used one when, I guess this was like pre-2000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite different to hear that. So I want to know, like, what made you take that approach with the metronome? Was it a teacher you had, or was it that you had a musical household?
I can't really remember why I got a metronome, but at some point, I guess I thought that it seemed like a good idea. And I started taking guitar lessons when I was 11 or 10. Yeah, I was 10. And I had teachers up until I was 20. So I probably, you know, heard about metronomes many times. And maybe I was like 15 or 16 when I got my first one. Around that time, 16 probably, was when I started to get like really serious about it. When I started actually practicing, because up until then I played a lot, but it was more, you know, just as I played TV, like video games, or and I played guitar. It was just something that I enjoyed and passed the time and was stimulating. At that time, when I was 16, I started the Musikgymnasiet, which is I guess like music high school or something, where when things got more serious.
Brown, let me just say there's another parallel there, because you were just talking about guitar players pre-2000 not using a metronome generally. When I was 16, that's when I discovered, that's like when the shift to become more serious happened. And that was like the main thing, was a metronome showed up in life. And I can tell you that like most players around me didn't use one. Like it was not at all like today. Like it was specifically the players who like wanted to get good. It wasn't like it just is now that just about everybody uses it.
It's not just guitar players, though. I mean, even drummers couldn't play to a metronome until 2006, generally. Like the amount of drummers in the early 2000s that just didn't play to a metronome. You put a metronome on in front of them, they'd throw their sticks at you. You know, it was just pretty uncommon. So yeah, it's just good to hear that that's how, you know, you guys improved, as opposed to like, you know, how I did. I didn't even know what a metronome was until I started recording, you know?
Really?
No, I didn't use a metronome until I started recording myself with a DAW. And that was, I want to say, 2003 kind of time.
Mm-hmm. And now Everyone's like super attached to the grid, right?
Yeah, which is bizarre in itself, right?
Yeah, so now, and even in the past, well, forever with Scar Symmetry, we've been playing to a click for our live shows, because we don't have a keyboard player. So we have all the keyboards on track. So we've gotten into that as well. And I really miss, you know, jamming without a click.
Yeah.
That's such a different feel. I recently joined my buddy Morgan Ogren. He had a drum clinic in Stockholm. So me and Henrik Linder from Dirty Loops, we joined him and just did some, you know, spontaneous improv, like not even knowing what key we were going to play. And we obviously didn't have a click or anything. And that was just such a beautiful experience after all the time playing with a click.
Yeah, it's you capture the energy in the moment as opposed to just being forced into this time.
Yeah.
You know, like, and sometimes I feel like playing to a click in a live situation, depending on how you go on stage, sometimes songs feel either really slow or really fast, and it's not in the moment. Yeah, I actually kind of miss not playing with a metronome sometimes as well.
Yeah, it kind of works well for the music I do with Scar Symmetry, and I think it works well for your bands too, or
it has to.
Yeah, I think so.
But if you're trying to make, I don't know, a funk album, a jazz album, or something where you want for things to breathe a little bit more, it's like a click is horrible.
The shows where we didn't use a click, or like the rig broke, you know, that happened sometimes, or it just like there's an element about them that was fun. Like it was more wild.
Yeah, we've had that as well.
Yeah, but dude, there's like a flip side to it, which is like it can get so fast that it's like borderline unplayable. like that's, I feel like that, and like also borderline no groove anymore. Like it's fun, it's fun, like driving really fast or something. But if you did a good job on the record, choosing the right tempos, like I'm not saying that that has to be set in stone of what it needs to be every time, but there's a reason for why you picked that. It felt right. And so even though your perception when you're at a show, like you've got adrenaline, nerves, like you, there's all these reasons for why you're perceiving time differently. Mm-hmm. Like what, like Brown just said, like what you feel is slow might really be fast as fuck compared to other people. And so
yeah,
like using our own subjective feel, it could ruin the song. Like you hear some of these live recordings by these great bands and it's so fast mm-hmm. that it's like, I mean, it's fun, but like, it's not the song anymore.
It makes me think about some videos I've seen of Meshuggah in the early days.
Yes.
when they played like Future Read Machine,
God,
like twice the tempo from the album.
Yep. I think that when I first saw Meshuggah, which was 2004, must have been nothing at the time. I don't think they were playing to a metronome. I think it was all Thomas.
Might have been, yeah. I don't know when they started using the click track.
I remember Future Breed Machine feeling very fast. Sounded great still, obviously, though.
So I guess that means that you were using a click when you played with them.
Yeah.
Sounds like an obvious question.
Their entire stage setup now with all the flashing lights, everything is like tied to that click. So
makes sense.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, like this is just something that like I've been wondering for a couple decades now. So, you know, I'm going to ask you, following a click to that music, hard or easy? Is there a trick to it that like once you know what the trick is, it's like, oh, okay, that's all it is? Or is it as hard as it sounds to an outsider?
I don't think it's hard to play to a click at all. And especially not when you have Thomas Håke playing drums. Because like on his really good days, you can't even hear the click. It just disappears like on his hits because he's so precise. And I guess when I started playing with them, I had the click pretty loud in my ears. But after a while, I started turning it down so I could only like really hear it for the count-ins. And then I was focusing on playing along with Thomas instead, because I felt like things was grooving a little bit more, could lock in much better.
But I guess still, like, I guess so forget the click, but just the idea of learning that stuff. Is there a trick to it? Like, I guess, is it as hard as people think, or is there an equation that helps it make sense, or both?
It can be pretty like information dense learning the music, but there's also like a formula that's behind, I don't know, 90% of the riffs. So once you start like thinking in that kind of language, things starts to make sense. When I was prepping for my first rehearsal with them, I had asked Thomas what songs to learn. Like, give me a bunch that I can work on. And he gave me a bunch, and I learned maybe five songs. And then I show up to rehearsal space, and Thomas says, no, we're not playing two of those. I was like, oh, okay, thanks. Thanks, man. And then when I learned the next batch of songs, the same thing happened. No, I don't think we're going to play those two or three. And I was like,
oh,
no,
man.
Fuck, man. But eventually, like, since I kept playing with them for a while, all of those songs eventually, you know, popped up on the set list. But that was really interesting. And I didn't get any tabs or any sheet music.
What?
So I had to figure it out, all of it, on my own. So what I did,
since
all the albums, aside from the earliest ones, they are all recorded to the click track. So that made it easy for me, because I could import the song into my DAW, into Cubase, could line it up, you know, to the click, and I cut it up into sections. So I can be like, that's the intro riff, that's the verse riff, and so on. And for each riff, I created a MIDI part, you know, with the piano roll, and you can paste in 16th notes or whatever the subdivision is. And so I for each hit on the guitar, I put in a little dot on that note, because some of the riffs are kind of notey and some aren't.
So almost like replacing putting like slate trigger on something.
Yeah, I guess. But what
yeah. like replacing with MIDI?
Yeah, so what I used it for was that created a visual representation of the riff for me. And then I could see, I mean, some of the riffs were easy enough that I maybe didn't have to do it, but some riffs that were more, the cycles were longer. It really helped me because then I could see like, oh, it moves like that, and then it repeats, and then it repeats, and then it's a little thing at the end. And then I could have that visual representation with me when I played it.
Yeah, that's interesting that you learn visually as well, because I do that as well with the drum editor on Cubase. That's kind of how I see it, because it makes it a lot easier for than just the information, you know,
yeah,
the track. But I can't believe you didn't get any tabs. That is impressive.
Yeah, I don't think they've ever written any tabs for anything. I got a video.
That's kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah.
I received a video from Dick for like a couple of riffs.
That is insane.
Where there was like some cluster chords that was like kind of impossible to figure out because it just sounds like a chromatic, chaotic mess.
So I guess it's total sink or swim.
Yeah. <then.
laughs> I mean, literally just sink or swim. Like either you're going to learn this or you're not. The end.
Just out of interest, yeah, how long were you given to learn it?
I can't remember. I think we met for the first time in like February or March, and then we had the first tour maybe in June or July.
So 4 months.
Something like that. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, that's not long enough for most people on this planet to learn Mushuga.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. I've played a lot of weird stuff in my days, so.
Is there stuff that weird, though, once you know it and, like, once you figure it out?
A lot of it isn't that weird. And sometimes it's like, sometimes things that are easy to remember are hard to play. Sometimes it's like there might be a riff that is kind of simple, but there's just a little something that throws you off. There's been a couple of riffs like that I know that I have to be super focused when they arrive during the set. Like holy crap, it's the post solo riff, and then I close my eyes and be like, din, 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 you know, whatever. And then there's riffs that sound like super difficult, and it's really not.
It all just sounds crazy, though. Like, to the outsider, it sounds nuts. But actually, you know, I think that one of the reasons that they're so successful is because when it comes down to it, as crazy as their stuff sounds, it's not that weird in that it's like weird music. It's good music. So like, that's why people like it. I think that's why it connects with people. Cause actually when you break it all down, forget all the craziness, it's just good shit. Basically.
There is like some sort of common ground between Mushuga and AC/DC. If you know what I mean.
Yes. I'm glad you said that. Cause yeah, cause they rock really hard.
Yeah. And there are things in there that are simple. For a lot of riffs, it's not a lot of notes, and it's always that 4/4 thing going on. So it's not like it's really odd meter that it's hard to understand. So you always have that kind of snare on the 2 and 4, that kind of backbeat.
It grooves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the tech bands forget about that. I think that that's what they do great, is no matter what's happening, it's slamming.
Mm-hmm.
Does that experience influence you at all with Scar Symmetry or what you do, or is it compartmentalized?
I mean, Mushuga was always an influence for me, you know, before I played with them. There are riffs on Scar Symmetry songs that I think of them as like being like the Mushuga riff, because there's little metric modulation in there. And I don't know, I don't think playing with them has influenced me musically all that much, but it has influenced me in how to run a band, in how to manage a band, and in every aspect, because Scar Symmetry was always, even though we've done a lot of cool things and played big stages and you know, reached a certain level of success, we've always been sort of an amateur band in how we have run things. And sometimes I feel like it's incredible how far we've got without, you know, really doing anything right.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, so coming into Mushuga, where they have their own headquarters, they have their own studio and rehearsal space, they have their own crew that they travel with wherever they go. A lot of bands, if they go to the US, they have local crew, because it's much cheaper than have work visas and flights and everything for a Swedish crew. but they bring their own crew, you know, everywhere. They spend the money on that. And it really, that, you know, helps ensure the quality of everything regarding the show. And they have that, and they have a manager, like, that helps them. And they, yes, there's like a lot of things how they like organize around the music that really got me thinking. And like coming out of the Meshuggah experience and sort of bringing Score Symmetry back, I've taken that with me and sort of implemented the appropriate changes for me. I have a booking agent that is helping me sort of co-manage the band, helps me take the load off some of my burdens and help me out with stuff. I have a sort of personal assistant, guitar tech, video editor guy who does a little bit of everything that I've got on payroll now, who can do stuff for me that I don't really have the time or energy for. We've expanded our crew, and, you know, we have a bigger and stronger team around me. I got a new lawyer, and I got a new business accountant, business manager. So in the little time that I've been doing this, it's been so, so very helpful in every way. It just gives me much more energy and time to focus on the stuff that I'm good at, and that I feel is, you know, that makes me happy, and I can give away the stuff that I don't want to do to people in my little setup.
It's amazing how when you see something that has been dysfunctional for yourself for years, and you see the same thing working completely functionally in another situation, I think that really helps a lot of people. I mean, the same thing went with me when I filled in for Periphery, mm-hmm. you know, and I saw how they operated, which made me have the exact same feelings that you had. The same thing with Riffard to a degree as well, with Eyal, you know. I think that if you can, it's weird in this day and age, as bands, we're expected to do absolutely everything and learn absolutely everything, but generally there isn't enough time to do that, especially if you want your product to be good.
Yeah.
So I think that having a team of people around you that you trust, where you fly them everywhere to make sure that your show is 100%, I think it should be the norm, and it's really smart to do, isn't it?
Yeah. And there are some things about it, like there are some costs involved with having more people around you. But I'm like, if I have too much on my slate and stuff that I don't really want to do or that I'm not really good enough, it takes away so much of the stuff that I want to do and need to do, like write music and
that only you can do.
Yes,
that only I can do. That I feel like my career has been progressing too slowly because of this.
You know, it's like Brown just said that, like, there's this expectation that musicians and bands do everything themselves these days. And like, there's this idea, like, you know, if you're smart, you won't have someone else do this shit for you. But man, I just don't agree with that, because yeah, you should know what's going on for sure.
Yeah.
Obviously. Like, the idea of being the dumb musician that doesn't know what's going on, that's bad. That's really bad. But like, if you are trying to do everything to the point where you're hurting the reason that people listen to you in the first place, that I don't know how that's good. I just don't see how that's a productive thing. And like, I know these solo artists who are really, really good at doing this without like a traditional label, mm-hmm. or whatever. We all know these dudes, but honestly, they still have a team that basically acts like they basically built their own version of the traditional team.
Yeah.
But like, it's just I feel like it's a recipe for disaster trying to do everything yourself.
For the longest time, I was thinking about this, that I needed to put the team together, but I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know like who to work with. And it was sort of, it wasn't until like I really needed it and really started to like really think about it and start reaching out that suddenly everything just like fell into place.
Is it one of those things where like now that you've done it and are doing it, you're like, damn, I could have just done this before?
It feels a bit like that, but I've been thinking of doing it for such a long time, but I didn't know how to, and I guess that's that.
Yeah, that's kind of important.
But there's also certain things about it that felt like, you know, once you have one brick in place, the rest, you know, just falls into place, which is how I find that life works sometimes.
So before, like first time around with Scar Symmetry, was it like you were trying to do the accounting, you're trying to do the booking, you're trying to do the promotion, like, et cetera, and writing and playing?
A bit like that, yeah. We always had booking agents, but we were essentially self-managed. We had a label and we had a booking agent, but everything else we did ourselves. And yeah. And no one was in charge of anything. So it could be like an
it was a free for all.
Yeah, and an offer comes into the band email and no one replies because no one had checked this and everyone was expecting the other guy to handle it, you know. There was this one time, and I'm not gonna name any names, but we were going on a US tour, and I learned like 4 days before the show, I'm talking to another guy in the band, and I'm not gonna name any names, so to protect the not innocent, and then I realized that so we don't have a touring bus, we don't have a vehicle to travel in. No, I had so much to do. But you were the guy who set everything up and talked to everyone, and talked to the booking agency and the label and everything. And we don't have a tour bus. No, I'm sorry. And I was like,
wait. So you discover this when you got to the U.S.
4 days before?
No, it was maybe 4 days before the tour started. So I had to like jump on the phone and start calling, you know, like different bus companies, and we ended up getting an RV for the 5 week tour because that was the only time we drove ourselves through North America. That was really fun, and we figured it out, and you know, it was a cool experience, but that was like the our lowest point in this organization.
I just wanted to know, you did organize the US visas, right?
Oh, we had help with that.
Yeah, that is a procedure.
It is. We have experienced that one time when we didn't get the visas in time. We had prepared everything like way in advance, and usually like when everything's done, you can book a time at the embassy in Stockholm, and it's like the wait time to get an appointment is just like a few weeks. But then it was like the waiting time is 3 months, but that's like at the end of the tour. So we had to cancel the tour in 2012, I believe it was. So that was a bummer.
That's how you learn, though. That's how you man, I remember getting kicked out of England in 2005.
You probably deserved it.
never made that mistake ever again, of trying to tour without the work permits taken care of.
Yeah.
Just had a, yeah.
And it was one of those two where, like, man, it was before we were signed, we booked an independent tour of England, like paid it for it ourselves and all that shit. We were working with a dude in England, and I remember telling him, I was like, don't we need to get work permits? And he was like, oh, it's all good, mate. Like, all good, mate. Don't worry about it, mate. Just tell them you're on holiday, mate. You know, all that stuff. And we got there and got kicked out.
Yeah.
That it was so terrible.
What a bummer. Fucking
terrible. Yeah. Especially like an unsigned band that's like never done that before. Like, that's a big deal to be able to put that together and then just get sent home. It's like, disaster. But like, yeah, never happened again. It's a good way to learn.
Had a similar experience last week, actually. So,
oh god, yeah,
we got a really short notice offer for India that happened just this Saturday, just gone. Now, up until Brexit happened, you could apply for an Indian visa online, you know, just an e-visa. And then about a day or two after we accepted the offer, we checked, you know, to do the visas, and it's like, oh, you can't do e-visa now anymore for UK citizens. So then we got our visas on Thursday morning back, and the show was on Saturday. So they booked our flights for Thursday evening, and we got there. Well, Andy arrived about 12 hours before the show into India. It was very, very last minute for the visas. So yeah, make sure you check up on that if you're listening. Wow. Because it's a pretty horrible procedure for any visa.
So Brexit is affecting UK-India relations?
I'm not too sure, but the e-visa wasn't available to do anymore. Whereas our vocalist who lives in the US, he got a confirmation of his within 12 hours. And I had to go to London.
All right. So it's like now you don't have the EU backing you. So now we're going to get back to you for past transgressions.
Probably, yeah. And yeah, I would do probably the same thing if I wasn't here. You know? Yeah. What a dumb idea Brexit was, eh? Anyway, less of that. Let's not talk about Brexit. It'll make me really angry.
Let's talk about politics. And religion.
No, most certainly not. No, let's not do that.
Yeah, that's a great place to take things. I am very curious though about this idea of like how long was scar symmetry not around for?
We were never like not around.
Dormant.
I don't know. We never were a hard touring band. But I guess in the early days, we toured a bit more. I don't know, maybe from like 2011 up until now, we've been like maybe we've done like a tour a year or so.
So still doing stuff.
Yeah, but just not a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the Meshuggah thing came and then the pandemic. But we still did some shows during my Meshuggah years.
What changed though? Like, was it basically when the Meshuggah thing ended, you were just like, all right, I have seen the light. This is how things are going to go.
Yeah, I guess it was that. And before I started playing with Meshuggah, I guess like all those years in a band that was had some dysfunction in how we ran things, that kind of wore me out because I was always like the guy who had to take care of everything that hadn't been taken care of. And we went on tour and I was sort of the tour manager and the stage tech guy without, you know, being neither of them. But I still had to do those jobs. Finally, it just wore me out. And I kind of like fell out of love with the thing for a bit. I didn't really feel it because of that. And I felt like doing something else. And I started thinking that I would really like to play with a band where I don't have to do anything, you know. And once I started thinking about that and I was sort of focusing on that, and I got a call from Dark Tranquillity. They asked if I could help them with a tour, and they are friends of mine and great guys, but I ended up saying no because it's not 100% my music. There's not a lot of guitar solos, for example. but so that showed up and I was like, holy crap, like God heard my prayers. Except there is no God, so that's religion. So there I said it.
God is dead, in the words of Mike Åkerfeldt.
So then a few weeks later, I got a call from the Swedish power metal band Nocturnal Rites, and they asked me if I would like to join and make an album and start playing live with them. So I accepted because I was a fan of the band, and I figured it would be sweet to do some like more melodic metal, lots and lots of guitar solos. And then some more weeks later, I got a text message from Thomas from Meshuggah. Do you think you can do a tour with us? That's like what I talked about earlier, that sometimes you feel like the snowball starts, you know, spinning, and suddenly like all kinds of things happen that are connected to each other for whatever reason. So I got into that. I started playing both with Nocturnal Rites. We played all over Europe. We played Japan. We did the Prog Power Fest in Atlanta. And I started touring with Meshuggah. So I had a bunch of years when I did both those bands and not so much Scar Symmetry. And I got to get a taste of touring and performing and having all that support from a great crew. And I really liked it. But then at the end of it all, you know, I realized that, like, especially with Meshuggah, after a while, since it's not my music, I mean, I love the music and I love the band, and it was a great thing for me to play with them, but that at the end of the day, it wasn't my music. I was performing someone else's, you know, I was propelling someone else's career, or, you know.
Yeah, it's their band.
Yeah, so I started to really miss doing my own thing, and play music that I wrote and be like the main guy of my own thing. So when Fredrik decided that he was going to come back to Meshuggah, that came in the right place in time for me.
That makes sense. I relate a lot to what it's like to come from a dysfunctional situation and how much it wears you down. And Brown, you've been there too with the band. It seems to me like the band is like finally functional.
Don't say that.
Sorry.
No, it's more functional, yeah.
It seems like you guys are like operating in a way that is better than you've ever operated.
It's amazing how your mindset can change, firstly, when you put out new music. I think the moment that new music, it adds a lease of life anyway. But yeah, just having a team of people, as Poe was saying, having a team of people can really help your mental state. I still don't have a fucking guitar tech, though. Never had one.
Yeah, really?
I want one.
Dude, you could totally have a guitar tech.
Can't afford one, mate. But one day, because the 8 strings takes a lot longer than 6. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't have a floating bridge, at least, right?
That's the reason why as well. Yeah, because, yeah, it's just... I mean, even, you know, the guitars that, you know, Morten uses has the locking threads. I couldn't even be bothered with something like that. Whereas, you know, the Strandberg at least is like fairly straightforward, right?
Yeah. It's pretty quick to change strings on a Strandberg.
Should I get an 8 string?
Don't do it.
Don't. Okay.
Or do it. If you're like Pearl.
I'm really happy to be back playing only the 7 strings pretty much.
Got it. Yeah, I've never even held one before.
Yeah.
The thing about it is like, so there's this dilemma, right? The dilemma is before you can afford to have a team, how do you do it? Like, you know what I mean? Like there's a chicken and the egg thing.
Yeah.
Like, because if nobody knows who the band is, right? Like, I don't mean Scar Symmetry or my band or whatever. I mean like a band really early on where literally nobody knows who they are. There's a lot of people listening to this who are in that position who could be hearing us talking about, yeah, like it's the way Meshuggah runs shit. That's the way to run shit. But Meshuggah is a big fucking band who can afford it. So like, what do you suggest? Like in your mind, like if some guitar student or something was in that position, like starting out their band career, how would you advise them about like this topic in particular?
I guess you could sort of look to your own in your own circles, if you have friends or acquaintances that would like to get into the industry and that would like to start down on the floor where you are with your band, because like if there are people who want to start a career as a manager or a guitar tech or a sound guy, and they like to, so there are people who need to start somewhere, and for people like that it might be a good opportunity to start working with them, yeah, with a promising young band.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, is people at your level. Because I feel like if you're an unknown band, you're not going to be able to attract the top tier teams, right? You just can't. Like, you can't afford it. They're going to be busy.
Yeah.
With Meshuggah or whatever.
I think it also depends on, you know, you talk about the top tier team, but sometimes those top tier teams that you're talking about hear something special in a band and then pick them up, knowing that this is going to be a long-term goal. And I think that that's kind of what a lot of the smaller bands should hope for, that their music is resonating with the right people. I think if you've got a good product, then people will come along that are in that top tier. If not, though, I think Per's suggestion is great. Like finding your friends that you know are really good at something that want to get into the industry and want to take the same path as you, and that's to build up to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and who are down. You have to be willing to suffer a lot. I mean, no matter what, at any point in a music career, you got to be willing to suffer, but especially at that phase could go on for a long time. It could go on for a decade or 15 years. I mean, it could only go on for 6 months, right? But like, you have to be prepared for the fact that that stage could go on for over a decade and be okay with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's two things. I think you need to accept the fact that like the people you start with might not be the people you end up with, because paths might diverge. Also, I guess this is kind of tied into it too. Like, to be open to just like evolving the team whenever necessary?
It's a matter of prioritizing in your personal life, the way you live. Like, are you going to have an expensive apartment or something cheap so you can spend time with music and not be too worried about money? And maybe like you don't want to use a guitar tech, you change your own strings, and then you can afford to have a proper sound guy or light designer or something. So it's
order of priority. Yeah.
Don't be a spoiled brat such as me.
Well, I mean, the thing is, so what I'm thinking about now with the Doth situation is, I know that if I wanted to do everything, like if I wanted to run it like a company, like where I like run the company and like do the kind of shit I know how to do, I don't have the time for that. Like I just don't. Like I can't do URM and Riff Hard, have a personal life, play guitar, write music, and then also bring this band back from the dead, like on the business side. I just can't. It's not possible. Like I'm not going to sacrifice Riff Hard or URM or my relationship to do that. So I need a team. Like end of story, I need a team. And thinking about it now, like it's like, why would I do that without that? It's like, if anyone's able to, why wouldn't they do that? Everything is better when you have multiple brains on a project, I think.
And if you can't afford a guitar tech, just don't change strings for a whole tour.
Yeah.
See how it goes. Like I've done many times.
Backing tracks.
Yeah, innit?
I mean, if you're not going through the PA, no one can hear it anyways.
Yeah.
Right? Is that an Ignator amp behind you?
It is.
Okay. Nice.
My Nord stage.
Yeah, Nord as well.
I was actually getting ready to like wrap up the episode because I think a good place to end it. I just wanted to thank you for coming on, man. It's been a pleasure talking to you and catching up. And
yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And it's impressive that he quit guitar completely due to the injury and then came back even stronger. It's like no one would know based on how he plays.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine the mental barriers that he went through?
I can, actually. So
yeah, you didn't play for 7 years, so yeah.
Well, no, but that wasn't due to an injury, but I did injure myself at one point. So, and I know what it's like to like not be able to do the thing you wanted to do.
Yeah.
I get it. It's mentally destructive. So
it is.
I can imagine that he had to come to terms with a lot, which he did, and figured it out.
Then his like everything fixed itself. He found a way around it, and then he could play guitar again. And it's amazing just that changing your mindset to not be negative and be more positive about the other things that you're doing that can just like open up the possibilities for it to happen again. I really truly believe that mind over matter is a thing, you know, when it comes to injuries.
I just want to clarify that we don't mean like if you imagine it's gone. Mind over matter in that like he took the time he needed for it to physically heal while also getting his brain in the right headspace for it with the right attitude, kept developing musically until he was healed and then came back. But it's not like he sat there and was like, because I think it, my injury is goneth. I thinketh, then it's goneth. It didn't really like work that way. You can't think your way out of like an injury like that. Like you have to take time off.
No, you can't. No, exactly. But what I mean is that, you know, he could have sat and moped around and been particularly miserable about it. But having a more positive mindset, I think probably helped him get back to it quicker.
Which I'm sure he did for a little while, you know?
Yeah, everyone does. I mean, obviously, you know, I had to change how I approached the guitar because I developed psoriasis on my hands when I was 16. So often I would be, I used to shred, play lead and stuff like that. And then I had to make the decision that it's like, right, I can't do that anymore. But that's not a problem. It's all good. I can still play the guitar. I just have to think about it a little bit differently.
Yep.
And yeah, and for him, he could still write music. He just had to do it differently.
Totally. And I think that people need to just accept the fact that if you do hurt yourself, you know, you might need to stop and it's okay.
You can still do it just differently.
Yeah.
Look at Jason Becker. He still writes music to this day.
Yeah. But you do need to accept the reality because if you don't, you might just end up hurting yourself worse. So it is important to like accept reality and then do what you need to do to heal. And if that means that you have to take a month off or 2 months off or a year or two off, that's okay. Like guitar will still be here when you get back. And, you know, Riff Hard will be here when you get back.
Yeah.
I do think that it's key, though, that he kept developing his mind, his musical mind.
Yeah. He probably made more advancements in those 4 years, which translated to the instrument once he was able to pick it back up again.
Mm-hmm.
Like beyond anything that he might have even done in that 4 years of playing guitar, you know, because he was probably thinking about the guitar, thinking, visualizing the fretboard, but then couldn't do it. So he was developing anyway. You know, would he have done the same pathway if he was playing the guitar? It probably would have been a longer process because he, you know, he would have taken it for granted, in my opinion. Well, I definitely take for granted that I play, you know, sometimes when I play guitar, I take it for granted. And I think that the fact that he wasn't able to pick up the guitar made him developing in his mind more than he would have done if he physically had it in his hand.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that way too about my musical development over the past 7 years. So I totally get it. The thing is, he didn't just shut off. That's the key. He didn't leave music. He just stopped playing guitar. And there's a big difference. Like, he didn't just throw music away and go do something completely different and never think about it again. Then one day decide he was going to play again. Like, he kept it alive in his mind.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I know that there's people out there who are on the verge of hurting themselves or have hurt themselves and not admitted it to themselves yet, or, you know, because they don't want to accept that they have hurt themselves and might need to take some time off. But it's really important that you just like face the music and come to terms with reality for the, not as a tough love thing, but as a, you don't want to hurt yourself worse and like do something permanent to where you won't be able to play at all. Like if you look at the history of great musicians, lots of them have taken breaks or had to stop for whatever reason and came back to it just fine.
And came back stronger.
Yeah, exactly. There's tons of examples of that. So it's okay to take a break. What's not okay is to injure yourself worse and then be forced to stop like forever, possibly. I have seen that happen, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen it with a few people.
Crazy.
No one in our circle, but I've seen it before.
Yeah. If someone really enjoys their instrument, the last thing that I want to see is them not being able to play it again. So listen to your body. If it's hurting, stop immediately and go and sort it out. And then the guitar will be waiting for you when the healing process has happened.
That's right. It's not going anywhere. All right, Brown. Talk to you next week.
See you next week, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Riff Hard Podcast. We'll see you next week.